Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey everybody, I've got an important announcement to make of interest to all fans of true crime, so stick around to the end of the show. It'll cheer you up after what you're about to hear. This episode of True Crime Historian is brought to you by ZipRecruiter, which you can try for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/first, telling them I sent you. You can tell by the title of this episode that it's not going to end well, and it occurs to me that the sheriff here should have hired a better executioner, someone with a proven track record and solid skills. Obviously, they didn't have ZipRecruiter in 1889, but if you need a good executioner, or a sales manager, or a receptionist, or a historian, ZipRecruiter is the place to go to find the best candidates. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality people these days. If you want the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. You quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses to date. And right now, listeners to True Crime Historian can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/first. That's ZipRecruiter.com/first. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/first now. On with the show. Prologue. Ozark, Missouri, March 18, 1887. The bald knobber excitement here reached a climax last night at about 10 o'clock. Worn out with anxiety and sleepless vigils, many of the citizens of Ozark had gone to bed early, hoping that nothing startling would occur before morning to reagitate their already overtaxed nerves and drive away tired nature's sweet restorer. Suddenly, an alarm was sounded, and the sleeping inhabitants and dozing reserve guards rushed out on the streets and heard what seemed to be a veritable battle east of town. 40 distinct shots were counted in less than a minute, and the fear that a Bald Knob rescue party en route for Ozark had attacked Sparta became the ruling craze. The direction of the firing did not exactly coincide with a beeline to the neighboring village, but the occasion would not admit of a very close calculation as to the angular bearings of the two points with respect to the courthouse, and many of our people were ready to believe that Spartans were in deadly combat with the rallying clans of the Bald Knobbers of Swan Creek, Douglas, and Tawny. The courthouse yard soon became a scene of warlike preparation, never witnessed here since the bloody days of the 60s when human life in the Ozark Mountains was at the mercy of the deadly bushwhacker. Fresh details of guards were hurried to the eastern border of town in the direction of Sparta, and every available man, gun, and pistol was called into service. Sheriff Z.A. Johnson took a reconnoitering party and started east to examine the dangerous frontier. Most of the guards, be it said to their credit, showed the nerve of men who knew how to face the worst possible crisis in defense of law and order. 16-year-old boys stood in readiness to exchange shots with the masked and horned nobbers who might at any moment dash into town 500 strong and yelling to demolish the courthouse, unshackle the 25 prisoners, and take them away from the clutches of the law by the light of a general conflagration of the combustible parts of the public square. Lawyers, doctors, merchants, justices of the peace, and in fact the whole war footing of the town was soon under arms and waiting for the approaching conflict. But no bald nobbers appeared. The prisoners were the coolest men in town. They had all laid down on their hard and comfortless beds before the alarm was raised, and this fact intensified the fears of some people, as they thought this was feigned composure to throw the guards off their usual vigilance. It was supposed that the prisoners had received some kind of secret communication from their outside allies and were expecting the attack. The firing continued at short intervals until fully 100 shots were counted, when the explosions changed to the unmistakable sounds of 4th of July anvil booms. Then it began to dawn on the excited inhabitants that an old-fashioned shivery was congratulating a newly married couple. This soon became the assuring belief, and the excited women and children returned to their beds to dream of masked bands of outlaws rallying to the rescue of captured Confederates. Crime Historian presents An Eye for an Eye, a special edition of yesterday's news exploring the criminal justice system at its most extreme, inflicting the death penalty. This episode is a sequel to the tale of the giant vigilante Captain Nat Kenny, episode 7 that I posted back in February, about one of the bald nobber masked vigilante groups that sprang up in the Ozark region after the Civil War. This story concerns the bald nobbers in an adjacent county to Nat Kenny, where, once again, vigilante justice backfires. It's a good story and has a lot of action, including a jailbreak, but my favorite part is the heartbreaking report of the artist who ventures into the hills to get sketches of the families of the condemned men just days before their scheduled execution. I'll post the sketches on my website, but his word pictures are some of the most powerful I've come across in the historic newspaper archives. I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, and I give you Bald Nobber 2, The Botched Execution of Chief Bull Creek Dave. Ozark, Missouri, March 12th. 1887. This morning, two men were killed and three others badly wounded, about 2.5 miles south of Sparta. A man by the name of Green was killed, and a young man by the name of Eden was also killed. The father of young Eden was badly wounded, but is recovering so he can talk some, but no particulars are obtainable until the coroner's jury gets through. It is supposed the bald nobbers did the mischief. There has been considerable trouble for some time. Later information reveals the fact that Eaton is badly wounded in the neck and body. He is the father of the murdered Eden and the father-in-law of Green, who was also killed. One woman had a finger shot off and clothing badly burned above the waist, the clothing catching fire from the powder flash. Another woman was wounded in the head by a gun or an axe. Five in all, two killed and three wounded. They had talked against the bald nobbers, it is supposed. Ozark, Missouri, March 16th, 1887. Warrants have been sworn out for the arrest of 22 men, all living near Sparta and Chadwick, charged with having killed Charles Green and William Eaton, and 13 of them have been arrested and are now under a strong guard. A largely attended public meeting was held at the courthouse Sunday night, and strong resolutions against the Bald Knobbers adopted. Since then, the sheriff has been promptly aided by volunteer citizens in the work of arresting the accused parties. On hearing a rumor yesterday that a posse was having trouble with Bald Knobbers at Chadwick, another posse of leading citizens armed themselves and started for that place, but their services were not needed. Some expressed the opinion that the governor should take steps in suppressing the lawless organization, as it is a disgrace to the whole state, while others are confident that the local authorities, backed by the best people of the county, are able to accomplish the desired end and favor the immediate calling of a special term of the circuit court to try all the parties accused or implicated in the murder. James Eden, his wife, and their daughter, Mrs. Charles Green, have been removed from the scene of the homicide to this place and are stopping at the Finley House. Eden said yesterday, "My son William, about 3 months ago, was taken out of bed by a party of masked men and severely whipped. They told him they did it because he had said if the Bald Knobbers ever came around him, they would have to carry away their dead. William denied having said it, but it was known that we were all opposed to the organization and in favor of upholding law and order. Last Friday night, William and his wife and Green and his wife were all at my house. Mrs. Green was in bed sick and has been so the past 3 weeks. We all retired for the night, occupying the same room. About 11 o'clock, we were awakened by loud cursing outside and heard someone call out, 'Get out of here, damn you, or we'll kill you.' William replied, 'I will get out as quick as I can,' and expecting that he would be taken out again and whipped, as he had previously received anonymous notices to leave the country or take the consequences. Just then they smashed in the window, and my wife stepped to the door to raise the latch. It was violently burst open, and she was knocked backwards. The outer door was also forced open, and masked men crowded into the room. By this time we were up, and my wife handed me my self-acting revolver. Three of the men had caught me by the arms and attempted to take the weapon away from me. I threw one of them back, and they commenced shooting at us. As the men fell backward, I aimed to shoot, and think I did, as one of the chambers was empty next morning. One bullet struck me and passed through the back of my neck, and as I turned to see my assailants, I was struck on the head with an axe and fell senseless to the floor and did not regain consciousness until the next morning." Eaton's wounds, though severe, are not fatal, and he is rapidly improving. His daughter, Mrs. Green, is quite ill and received a shock from which there is scarcely a possibility of her recovery. As soon as the alleged Bald Knobbers entered the house, in her excitement she got out of bed, and by the aid of a lamp which was burning she could see what was going on. She says, "I saw my husband shot through the head, and he fell dead near where I stood, and my brother William shot in the face. One of the men placed the muzzle of his gun close to my breast, but as he fired, I jerked the gun to one side with my left hand, the bullet striking my little finger, and with my right hand I tore the black mask from the man's face and recognized him as Bud Ray. The men then hastily left the house, and as they were going, one of them fired at my brother, who was partly lying on the bed. 4 buckshot entered his back. I think that was the shot that killed him. I think there were 20 or more shots fired in all, and about that number of men in the house. After the shooting, there was blood on nearly everything in the room. My little 3-year-old girl was on the floor by the side of her dead father, and my babe on the bed. Both had blood all spattered over them, but neither were hurt. The house where the murder was committed is made of logs and stands on the homestead of Green near the railroad, nearly 3 miles east of Sparta. The Greens came from Wisconsin and have lived in that locality for the past 3 years, as also has the Eden family. The latter formerly lived in Webster County, Kentucky, and all bear excellent reputations among the people in and around Sparta. Springfield, Missouri, March 16, 1887. Deputy Sheriff Neville of Christian County arrived here this evening with Joe Inman, the bald knobber who turned state's evidence against the 30 who participated in Friday night's bloody raid. Inman was badly frightened, appearing always in dread of violence from the knobbers for giving them away. But even after arriving here, he did not breathe easily until behind the bars. Tonight he was induced to talk a little. His eyes seemed still dilated from his continued slate of apprehension from bald knobbers. "It's a heap bigger thing," he said, "than most people have any idea of, and the members of the bald knob gang are more desperate and more powerful than is supposed. Why, there are 800 in Christian County, and there are members even in Springfield. I'm awful glad I got here safe." "How came you to make a confession?" he was asked. "I was taken out, a rope put round my neck, and told I would be hung if I didn't." Ozark, Missouri, March 16, 1887. Sheriff Johnson and posse arrived here last night from the vicinity of Chadwick with 11 more bald knobbers who are lodged in the courthouse, which is being used as a temporary jail for the outlaws. The number of prisoners now in Ozark is 19, which is supposed to embrace the leading spirits of the Bald Knobbers organization in Christian County and the majority of the masked band concerned in the murder of the Green family last Friday night. Some of the prisoners have been very much dejected and refused to talk about anything, while others are quite communicative, and considering the grave charge under which they are held, very cheerful in appearance. They all protest their innocence of any connection with the massacre of Friday night, and also disavow the slightest knowledge of the inside character of the Bald Knobbers organization. It is confidently believed by the officers and best-informed citizens here that the Bald Knobbers conspiracy of Christian County will be thoroughly broken up in the trial of these prisoners, and that most of the parties concerned in the killing of the Edens and the Greens are now in the courthouse, gloomily meditating the horrors of that cowardly crime and the prospect of inevitable punishment through a vigorous enforcement of the law. The officers know much that cannot yet be made public, but they do not hesitate to say that a clue has been discovered which will lead to a thorough and irresistible disclosure of not only the parties involved in the murder of the Edens and Greens, but also of the whole dark history of Bald Knob lawlessness in Christian County. One of the bald knobbers was shot in the massacre Friday night, either by Old Man Eden or some one of his masked accomplices. This wounded man is thought to be young Bill Walker, son of Dave Walker, who is now here under arrest. A double-barreled shotgun was left by the bald knob assailants in Eden's house after the massacre, and this fact, together with a bloody trail found leading off into the woods from the scene of the slaughter, has furnished the clue which now points definitely to young Walker as the man who was shot. Young Walker has not been seen since Friday night, and different members of his family give conflicting statements as to his whereabouts, one saying he went away from home a month ago, others that he left last Sunday. His father claims that he's in Pierce City, and his mother locates him yet elsewhere. It is believed that young Walker is hiding in the woods, about 3 miles from Chadwick. The gun has been examined by several parties who say there is no doubt that it belongs to young Walker, as it is peculiarly made and easily identified. The officers thought if Joe Inman could be separated from the other knobbers, a full confession of his knowledge of Friday night's tragedy might be obtained. He was therefore taken out of the courtroom, and after feeling his way cautiously for some time, said he would make a clean breast of the whole affair so far as he had any connection with it. He was taken back in the coroner's office over the bank, and in the presence of prosecuting attorney Watson, Sheriff Johnson, Deputy Sheriff Miller, and Coroner J.P. Ralston, made a full statement which he signed. He says that on last Friday night, the Bald Knob Company to which he belonged, commanded by Chief of Bull Creek Dave Walker, met at the old smelter on Bull Creek for the purpose of going down to Chadwick to pour out some whiskey kept by Bucky Bill Roberts. There are about 30 of the band, about one half of whom were mounted, the others being on foot. After going some distance, it was decided that the trip would be too laborious for the footman, and Chief Walker told the latter to go home while he and his mounted nobbers would ride down and dispose of the whiskey. About this time, they came in sight of the Eden's house, which was near the railroad, on which the unmounted members of the band were walking. Some of the younger nobbers proposed to go down to the house and have some fun. The chief, Walker, he says, protested against this movement, but the reckless boys started at once on a full run toward the house. Inman says he remained on the railroad till the party reached the house and began the firing. As soon as the nobbers got to the house, they knocked both doors down, when old man Edens fired at the crowd and shot young Bill Walker in the groin. The nobbers then returned fire and did the fatal work, which left the house in a horrid scene of slaughter. When the firing began, he and the rest of the party that had stopped on the railroad down to the house and tried to stop the massacre. He says the men who first ran down to the house and did the shooting included young Bill Walker, assistant chief of the band. He says the chief, Dave Walker, did all he could to prevent both the attack on the house and the subsequent firing. Young Bill Walker was, he says, fatally shot, as he saw him lie down in the yard and pull off his mask, which was left on the ground. Inman did not know, he says, that anybody was killed, thought some of the family were hurt from the cries he heard. About 10 shots were fired, he thinks. As soon as the shooting was over, the party left the house, Dave Walker assisting his wounded son in getting away. When they had gone a short distance, Chief Walker told him to come and get some other nobbers to go back and get his son's gun and watch, which they refused to do. He says he knows the boys had no thought of serious trouble when they started to the house and only meant to have a little bald knob sport. As soon as this confession was made, the sheriff went at once to the courtroom and handcuffed the parties most seriously criminated in Inman's statement. Preacher C.O. Simmons, Joseph Hyde, two of the Matthew boys, and the two Heights were placed in irons. They were almost overcome with horror when this new development took place and knew, no doubt, that Inman had given them away. C.O. Simmons sent for your reporter, and the only request he had to make was that he might be furnished with a small testament that he could hold in his manacled hand. He said he did not know that he could get any comfort from the Word of God, however, with those horrid things going on. A small copy of the New Testament was soon found and sent as a present to the terror-stricken preacher, whose face was, indeed, a most pitiable index of mental torture. Hyde's expression for being handcuffed was also livid and horrible. The rest of the iron nobbers were also very gloomy, but they did not so completely break down. Inman says he joined the Bald Knob organization under protest, being forced at the muzzle of a shotgun with a rope around his neck to swear allegiance to the deadly fraternity. This, he says, is the way many were taken into the organization. He had, he says, admitted to the chief of the band that the pouring out of the whiskey at Chadwick last summer was a good thing, and soon after he was invited out one night and initiated in the order in the manner above described, an ironclad organization. He says that once in the organization there is no getting out, as any betrayal of the secrets of the band is certain death. He says he wanted to be out of the order from the night he was forced to join it, but dared not attempt to free himself from his terrible oath. He states that he has many times feigned sickness to avoid going out with the band, and has more than once been warned to take a more active part in the nightly operations of the masked outlaws. He says there are about 700 bald knobbers in Christian County. He has been so told by other members of the order. Fully 3/4 of the men in the eastern part of the county, he says, belong to the Bald Knobbers. They always told him the object of the organization was to put down crimes such as the civil law could not suppress, selling whiskey, keeping loose women, etc. Inman begged to be taken to Springfield after making his confession, as he said life would pay the forfeit of his treachery if the Bald Knobbers could get to him. He would not think of staying with his late Confederates in the courthouse, though armed men were inside as guards. He was accordingly taken to the Springfield jail this afternoon on the 3 o'clock train. Inman's confession has produced the most intense excitement here, and rumors are again rife of a contemplated attempt on the part of the Bald Knobbers to release the prisoners tonight. Most people here think this is all groundless sensation. The law and order sentiment is now on top and means to hold the vantage at all hazards. Mrs. Green is better today, and old man Edens is able to walk about. Rumors of a growing mob feeling in the country come in town now and then. All people here seem determined that the Knobbers shall have a fair trial and the organization crushed by civil law. A subscription paper was started in town this morning to procure funds to prosecute the case and was liberally signed. More men and guns have been sent for, and the surrounding country is responding liberally to the call. The town will be strongly guarded tonight, and any attempt to release the prisoners will be met with a most determined resistance. Springfield, Missouri, April 13, 1888. The finding of the jury in the Dave Walker case created no surprise, as it was almost a foregone conclusion that he would be found guilty of willful murder with the rest of the Bald Knobbers. A gentleman who arrived from Ozark last evening stated to this correspondent that while they disclaimed to the contrary, the county and state officials and a great number of the best citizens of Taney and Christian counties felt uneasy at the result of the Bald Knob trials. "To all appearances," said the gentleman, "the Bald Knob organization is completely broken up, and the hanging of the four principals in the Green and Eden's butchery will forever deter the breaking out again of a like spirit. There is, however," he said, "a great number of the old organization who feel bound to stand by their old associates to the end, and I'll venture to assert that more than 100 citizens of the Bald Knob counties firmly believe that an attempt will be made to deliver Walker and his confederates before the sentence of the law can be executed. The feeling of uneasiness is growing, and the volcano is liable to burst at any time. Walker will be sentenced this week, and if appeals in all the cases are decided against the prisoners, active preparation for the quadruple hanging will at once commence." Ozark, Missouri, April 13, 1888. At 5 o'clock yesterday morning, the sheriff called Judge Hubbard and the attorneys on each side of the Dave Walker case to the courthouse, which even at that hour was filled with people before the jury could get in. The 12 jurors were called, and Judge Hubbard asked them if they had agreed on a verdict, when the foreman answered, "We have." The verdict was handed to the circuit clerk, and he read it in a loud and distinct voice. "We, the jury, find the defendant David Walker guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in the indictment." As the jury passed out, David Walker said, "I thought them men had better sense than that." The sheriff took Walker back to the jail to get his breakfast. He did not break down in the least, but said when he got back in the jail that they had tanned Bull Creek's hide. David Walker was brought back to the courtroom later in the day for sentencing, and the judge asked if he had anything to say why the sentence should not be passed. He said he did not have a fair trial, and they had done everything they could to convict him. He was sentenced to hang May 18th, the same day as John Matthews, Wiley Matthews, and William Walker, his son, are to hang. Amos Jones, William Stanley, and C.O. Simmons pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and will be sent to the penitentiary today. Ozark, Missouri, December 29, 1888. The long-talked-of Bald Knobber escape came last night, and John and Wiley Matthews are now at liberty, somewhere in the woods of Bull Creek, perhaps. Dave and Bill Walker declined the offer of temporary freedom and were found in their cells a few minutes after the escape of the Matthewses and five others, every door between them and the outside world being open. Bill Walker gave the alarm while the clatter of the hoofs of the horses bearing away the escaping murderers could be heard on the streets of Ozark, and Sheriff Johnson found the Nobber chief and his son standing in the open doors of their cells, the two most prominent figures in the history of the Green Edens murder being the sole occupants of the cell, except Clay Brucker, whom the rescuers had left lying in bed, gagged and bound head and foot. The prevailing opinion here is that the delivery is not the work of Nobbers, but was planned and executed by the friends of five young men who were in jail on the charge of breaking into a freight car near Billings, Christian County, about 2 months ago. The delivery occurred about 2 o'clock this morning. The jail was entered from the south through the wall just above the stone foundation. A hole in the brickwork, nearly large enough to admit the body of a man, showed how the rescuers had reached the cells of the prisoners. The brick wall is 18 inches thick, and to penetrate this required but little time and work for men supplied with burglar tools, as the rescuing party evidently were. Inside this wall are the steel cells and corridor, supposed to be saw and fileproof. The corridor door has a combination lock, but the combination had not been used for several months. In addition to the combination, the corridor is locked with a strong steel bolt. By the side of the corridor door is a large lever which fastens the cell doors with a sliding bar of heavy steel. In addition to the sliding bar worked by the outside lever, the cell doors are secured with padlocks. The corridor door and lever working with the sliding bars for the cells are locked with the same key. After the friends of the escaped prisoners crawled through the hole made in the brick wall, they had to unlock the corridor door and lever. Raising the lever withdrew the sliding bar from the cell doors. When the corridor door was unlocked with the same key that is used for securing the lever, the padlocks on the cell doors were all that remained between the prisoners and liberty. These were taken off the cell doors and left on the steel floor of the corridor. The big iron door that enters the jail from the front hall was not opened. The prisoners had only to pass out of their cells into the corridor, then through that apartment to the hole in the wall, crawl through the opening, climb the plank fence enclosing the jail yard, and they were at liberty. How the rescuers procured keys that would unlock the corridor and cell doors is, of course, the mystery. Sheriff Johnson had all the jail keys in his family room in the front of the jail building. The prisoners locked in the cells last night were the four bald Nobbers under the sentence of death, Dave and Bill Walker, John and Wiley Matthews, the four train robbers, and Clay Brucker, a young man of Christian, charged with obtaining money under false pretenses. Last night there was a shivery at the Widow Robertson's, 1 mile west of Ozark, celebrating the marriage of her daughter, which occurred the previous evening, and most of the boys of the town participated in this affair. The young men were returning to town till 1 or 2 o'clock at night, and the noise made by the horses and horns and bells of the riders furnished an excellent cover for the work of the jail delivery. Sheriff Johnson and his family were sleeping in the upper rooms of the jail building in front of the cells. William Fisher, one of the sheriff's guards, occupied a room immediately over the prisoners. At 12 o'clock, Johnson heard a noise about the jail and called Fisher. The sheriff and his guard both got out of bed, took their shotguns, and walked around the south side of the jail where the entrance was made. Everything seemed quiet, and after watching a few minutes, the sheriff and assistant went back to bed. The town still seemed to be in a stir, but Johnson thought the noise was made by the boys returning from the party. The sheriff felt uneasy and did not go to sleep again. At about 2 o'clock, Fisher called Johnson and told him there was someone about the jail. Johnson got out of bed, cocked both barrels of his shotgun, and went downstairs a second time, now seriously apprehensive that a rescue attempt was being planned. He walked around the south side of the jail and saw a light shining through the hole which the friends of the prisoners had entered, but thought it the reflection of a lamp in his cell, and the sheriff supposed the light was shining through the window. At this time, the rescue party was in the jail, and had the officer known the fact, he could have covered the hole in the wall with his shotgun and bagged the entire gang. After standing on the cold ground barefooted for several minutes, the sheriff concluded that it was a false alarm and went upstairs to his room. In about 15 minutes from this time, Johnson heard Bill Walker call, and on entering the jail, found 7 of his prisoners gone. Dave and Bill Walker say the prisoners had all left before they were awakened. Bill Walker says the first intimation of the affair he had, a man came to his cell door and punched him, whispering, "If you want to go, now's your chance." Young Walker says he at first thought it was a mob and drew his knife in defense. Dave Walker, who was in the same cell, had a razor and likewise made ready to resist the apprehended violence. The men whispered to the Walkers again, "If you want to go, the jail is now open." The Walkers say they then refused to go out and the men left. There were but 3 men in the jail, all armed with pistols. As soon as the jail became quiet, Bill Walker says he called the sheriff, thinking that all the prisoners except himself and his father had gone. He soon heard a noise in one of the cells, and going in found Rucker tied hand and foot and gagged. He released Rucker, and by that time the sheriff had come down. Rucker says he was awake when the 3 men entered the jail. They had no light and burnt only 2 matches while inside. They unlocked the corridor without the slightest difficulty and called for Wallace in a whisper. Wallace is supposed to be the real name of one of the train robbers. The 5 train robbers began to go out the hole in the wall at once. The hole proved to be too small for one of the men, and they worked several minutes enlarging it. John and Wiley Matthews responded readily to the invitation to leave the jail and pass quietly out of their cells without paying any attention to the 2 Walkers who seemed to be asleep. As soon as the 7 prisoners had left their cells, Rucker says one of the strangers told him to go. On refusing to accept the offer of liberty, one of the men thrust a pistol in his face, telling the prisoner not to move or speak under pain of death. The other men tied and gagged Rucker. Dave Walker gave the following account of the way the prisoners escaped. The hole in the wall of the jail, which was about 14 inches square, was made by persons on the outside, and shortly before 2 o'clock they crawled through it and, with keys of some sort, opened the cell door and told all the prisoners to come out. Walker and his son and Caleb Rucker refused to go. Dave Walker says he did not go with the rescuers because he did not wish to go that way. He anticipated a commutation of sentence, and his son says he prefers to be hanged than to be hunted and hounded by officers. Springfield, Missouri, April 26th, 1889. As the 10th of May draws near at hand, interest revives in anything connected with the condemned Bald Knobbers. The all-absorbing topic in this section of Missouri is, will the governor commute their sentence, or is the law to have its full sway? It is a serious question, one that finds many advocates pro and con. There is certainly no doubt that ignorance caused the crime. It was not premeditated, but one of those hasty, heated murders caused by the blinded fury of brute nature at a moment when they thought they were doing justice to the community. This correspondent left one bright morning last week for the homes of these unfortunate men, leaving the Chadwick branch of the Frisco Railroad 4 miles beyond Sparta, and at the very place where the murder for which they are to die was committed. I walked up the hill to the house of Sam Preston. It was a log cabin, surrounded by the ever-present peach trees now in full bloom. Sam Preston and his wife stood at the gate, eyeing me curiously, not being altogether certain whether my errand was friendly or otherwise. They seemed to be ever on the lookout down here for United States Marshals or their deputies. Upon explanation of my visit, he volunteered to show me the way to Dave Walker's home, and we accordingly set out down the track on our journey. Sam Preston is by no means a lovely specimen of humanity to look at his face. His physique is fine, and his heart, at least, toward the unfortunate families who are suffering for the follies of others, is warm indeed. Uncle Sam, as he is called, is a genuine nobber. He had the unpleasant experience of being very nearly lynched by the excited citizens after the tragedy. It was proved, however, that he was not in the Walker raid, though he served a jail sentence in Jefferson City for violating the United States law in his connection with the organization. Trudging for over a mile along the railroad, which runs on top of a high ridge all the way to Chadwick, deep ravines would every little while open to the view, down whose rocky sides poured a confused mass of fallen timber, heaped and piled together with loose boulders as far as the eye can see, while through the gaps thus afforded, away into the distance, could be seen range after range of wooded mountains until lost in the hazy space. Coming upon one of these gulches, they all looking alike to me, my guide told me to follow it down until I came to the Walker place, that I could not miss it, as the house was not quite half a mile away. Alas, for miles and half miles to these natives. They are certainly a very robust growth to bear so small a name. Down the hollow, over dead trees, stumbling and slipping on loose stones, here startled by a gliding snake or scampering lizard, now charmed with the crystal beauty of a mountain spring, your correspondent made his way. The year is at its prettiest. The wildflowers are in bloom. Underfoot peep Johnny Jump-ups, violets and buttercups, daisies, anemones, sweet williams, and many other flowers strangers to me. The forest trees, which have grown here quite undisturbed by the woodman's axe, were bare, but their somberness was lighted by the hackberry's white and the redbud's scarlet blossoms, intermixed with the bright green foliage of the underbrush. In spite of all this beauty, the silence was oppressive. Not a sound, except now and then the faint twittering of a chickadee or sparrow reached my ear. And when I suddenly came upon a magnificent formation of rocks, a cave from which a clear mountain stream came merrily rippling, I found the stillness so impressive and solemn that I could not enjoy its beauty. Now the springs, of which I had passed a number, supplied a considerable brook, winding in and out, which gave me new trouble in climbing out of its way or jumping over it, rather than continue my walk with damp feet. There was not altogether a lack of pleasure in this last obstruction, for in the clear water I discovered food for considerable amusement. The minnows, glistening in the sunlight, silver, red, yellow, and gray, they darted hither and thither under dead leaves and over the shining pebbles. At last, it seemed to me I had gone a mile or more, the gulch spread out into a little valley containing probably 10 acres of level ground, hemmed in on all sides by towering knobs, a place where several ravines run together, emptying their streams into a common channel, the head of Bull Creek. Here I espied the sought-for cabin, a small mud and log house which seemed to be deserted. It certainly was not the one I was after, or if it was, they had left it, so after climbing vainly around over the ridges and walking up and down the ravine in hopes of finding another habitation, I gave up, sketched the one and only house I could find, and retraced my steps. I walked as briskly as possible back to the railroad and thence to Chadwick, some 3 miles distant. At Chadwick, having secured a bright little fellow to guide me, I set out for John Matthews' house, nearly 2 miles from town. Down a ridge road, as before, that seemed ever and anon opening into wild and rugged valleys and steep mountains, we soon came to a jumping-off place where the ridge seemed to abruptly end. Below us, deep in a little valley, nestled John Matthews' small cabin. The red and pink peach blossoms formed a garland around his home. There dwell his wife and children, 9 in all, the oldest not yet 20. John Matthews was a kind, affectionate father. He loved his home, his wife, his children, and they plainly show in each look and action how deeply they love him. The shadow of the gallows, which is falling fast over him, will not cast a shade upon the bright, pure love that burns so steadily for him in this poor, poverty-stricken little cabin, lost in the valley among the Ozarks. Mrs. Matthews met me, and being told I had come to sketch herself and home, expressed her willingness to lend me all the assistance in her power. Poverty, wretchedness, and anxiety have written sorrow upon her face, once handsome. Her dress, a faded brown, was patched until it would be hard to tell which was the original material. She wore a green sunbonnet, limp and torn. Her shoes were of the coarsest and badly worn. It could be plainly seen that her mind was fast giving way under the strain upon her mental and physical nature. Every now and then her thoughts would wander, and she would say, "God only knows what we will do if they don't let him come back to us. We will starve." And to look at the children, it certainly seemed to be a fact. Ragged, half-fed, and dirty. Not their faces, but their clothes. You could see the bare skin in a dozen different places. They were made up of patches, and the 5 youngest had whooping cough. By giving them a nickel, I succeeded in getting them to stand until I sketched each one. The youngest, a baby girl not over 2 years, seems to be the best dressed of all, if to have on a dress not full of rents, however dirty it might be, could be called dressed. Her baby pink calico slip, gray woolen stockings, baby shoes void of all buttons, and tumbled yellow hair make up the picture, and she had a rather pretty face. The twins came next in order, about 5 years old, a boy and a girl, ragged beyond description. A little chap of 7 was the raggedest of all the ragged. His clothes were almost as old and worn as his name, William Abraham. Annie, nearly 9, was in bed sick, and Isaac and Richard were away. Sarah Hannah, just budding into womanhood, had a sweet, sad face, and keenly listened to anything I might say bearing upon the chance of her father's escape from hanging. Had Sarah been in any way dressed nicely, she would have been pronounced pretty. Dressed as she was in a many-patched bed-ticking dress, she was comely and struck the fancy at once. She and her mother toil in the field, plow, hoe, and saw wood, and in every way do a man's work. Jimmy Matthews is the youngest child. He is a fine-looking young man of 18 or 19, upon whom devolves the care of a large family. He was dressed neatly and has the reputation of being a good son. Jimmy cuts the ties and hauls them to Chadwick. He told me that if successful in not having ties thrown out, as he calls, he can cut 6 a day, earning 60 cents for a hard day's work. Often their ties are thrown out as defective, and his work yields him little or nothing. The home where John Matthews has raised his family thus far is a 1-room log cabin with a shed behind it. It is situated down in the valley, surrounded by a small tract of land, their chief dependence, land that would appear too stony to raise much. They have a few chickens and ducks, 2 horses, and some other stock. Inside the cabin, poverty was plainly manifest. In the shed attached to the house I have mentioned were two empty barrels, by the side of which stood a broken spinning wheel, still made to lend assistance in their desperate struggle for existence. The main room contained two beds, three old split-bottom chairs, and a small table. One side of the house was occupied by a great fireplace, upon which smoldered a few half-burned embers. On a shelf above the mantelpiece were a number of tin cans, bottles, and some odds and ends. Two rifles, one a Winchester, hung on a rack under the rafters. A pone of corn was upon the table. This was the only thing I could see to eat, though I looked carefully. They certainly had something else, but I am confident starvation is pressing them hard. Next morning, I walked down to Sam Preston's again, and there gained the services of Judge Reuben Hale, an ex-Baldnobber and member of the county court, to guide me to the Walker place. Judge Hale is a very clever gentleman and gave me considerable information about the organization and the Walker family. A half hour's walk brought us within sight of Dave Walker's homestead. It is a low wooden structure, half log and half oaken boards that have warped, leaving a very poor shelter indeed. The chimney is made of mud and rock, supported by logs placed crosswise. A log stable, with cracks between the timbers large enough to run your hand through, and an old log corn crib constitute the outbuilding. The Walker place, as well as the other mentioned, lies in the valley and is also cut up by the creek, which winds around through the farm. They have about 10 acres in all, and were out in the field when we came, the women plowing. The dooryard was scrupulously clean. So was the inside of the house, which presented about the same appearance as the Matthews place, save that the fireplace is a little larger, and in one corner near it is a small cooking stove set up on blocks. The floor is clean, though rough, unfinished boards, while on the walls a few odds and ends were hung. Mrs. Walker appears to be about 50. Her hair is not gray, her features are regular, and Mr. Hale tells me she used to be pretty. However, care and worry have left deep lines on her face. She was dressed in a dark, neat, though badly worn dress. Her hair was combed back and fastened tidily. She talked quite freely and deeply feels the humiliation of her situation. She has dismissed, however, all hope of the governor interceding, and feels very sad. Mrs. Dave Walker has 9 children. The 2 oldest girls are married. The oldest boy, Willie, is to be hung with his father. The others are still at home, and at my request they stood very still while I made rough sketches of them. The baby came first, a pretty little tot of 3 summers. Next I sketched Abraham, who must be about 5. The boys were all ragged, but not dirty. Solomon Leroy was certainly the most dejected-looking of all, being pretty nearly a bundle of rags. Charles Newman, the oldest of the boys, being nearly 9, had a business-looking air about him as though he felt himself the head of the family and fully comprehended the burden upon his youthful shoulders. Mary Bell, a pretty girl of 15, was barefooted, plowing in the field when we came, and when she found her sketch was next, succeeded in shoving her bare feet under the low chair to prevent them from being taken in the picture. Frances Elizabeth, the oldest girl at home, hastened to don her best clothes before permitting me to sketch her. She is a very good-looking girl. In fact, they are a good-looking family. But work they must, and these girls are used to all the manual labor of the farm. It is indeed hard work now to keep the wolf from the door, and it will still be harder, for they are likely to lose their farm and home. The lawyers have mortgages on their little places to secure their fees, and will undoubtedly soon leave these poor wretches homeless and shelterless, for lawyers must be fed, you know. Ozark, Missouri, May 9th, 1889. The scaffold on which the Bald Knobbers are to be executed tomorrow is almost completed. It is a rough pine plank concern, erected adjoining the jail on the east end. The drop is about 6 feet. William Walker was baptized this afternoon, Reverend Thomas Hankin, elder in the Baptist Church, officiating. The young man made profession of religion several months ago and manifests a wonderful resignation to his fate. On yesterday, he addressed a very feeling letter to his mother, bidding her farewell and requesting her to resign herself to his fate and not to grieve. He also asked her to not come down, as she would not be granted the privilege of seeing him or his pa. John Matthews' wife, children, and mother came in on Tuesday. The meeting was heartrending in the extreme. Matthews knelt in prayer with his family and commended them to the care of the Savior of man, after which he shook hands with his wife, children, and his old blind mother and returned to his cell. The workmen who are building the scaffold report that Dave Walker broke down during this afternoon and refuses to talk. The sheriff has summoned a jury of 12 men to witness the execution and a guard of 50 men to keep order. Everything is quiet, and no person anticipates any trouble, though the town will no doubt be crowded with people. Sketches of the Condemned. Dave and William Walker and John Matthews were condemned to death for the murder of Charles Green and William Edens near Chadwick in Christian County, Missouri, on the night of March 10, 1887. Their murderers were Bald Knobbers, and their grievance was that the Eden family, with which Green was connected, had talked to Guinness. The men were accompanied by Wiley Matthews, who was also condemned to death, but escaped from jail and is now supposed to be in the Indian Territory. William Stanley, who was sent to the penitentiary for 21 years, a Baptist preacher, C.O. Simmons, who has been sent to the penitentiary for 12 years, and others who turned state's evidence to save themselves. Bull Creek Dave Walker, according to his own story, was born in Christian County, Kentucky in June 1843. His parents moved to Christian County, Missouri when he was 4 years old and settled near Sparta. The section they settled on was at that time a part of Greene County. They had a hard life up to the war. Dave enlisted in Company M, 6 Missouri Volunteers, in 1862. But after a few months' service was discharged as he was underage. He went back home but had a stronger inclination for war than ever and enlisted in Company H of the 16th Missouri. His age was not found out, and he went through the war. After the war, he returned to Bull Creek and entered 40 acres of government land. This was his homestead. He joined the Bald Knobbers 3 years ago, when the first company was formed in Christian County, the Bull Creek Company, and he was made the chief. He claimed that besides the pouring out of liquor at the Chadwick Saloon and the whipping of John Evans for cutting up in church, his company had not done any regulating. It was the whipping of Evans which excited the hostility of the Edens. William Walker is the oldest son of the Bald Knob chief. He was born March 5, 1870. He lived on the farm with his father all his life and joined the Bald Knobbers at the same time. He was wounded in the right groin at the Green Edens killing and that night was taken to his uncle's house in Douglas County. He was captured later by Sheriff Johnson with the assistance of J.D. Newton, a brother of Walker's sweetheart. John Matthews was born on Bull Creek in Christian County, Missouri, 5 miles from Chadwick on April 29, 1848. He was in the Union Army during the war, enlisted in the 46th Missouri. he took part in several engagements incident to General Price's raid. He had 9 children, and most of them are small. He was a member of the Baptist Church and had been a bald knobber but 2 months when the shooting occurred. His son Jimmy, 14 years old, was at the Eden's house the night of the killing and was indicted with his father, but was released by the court after furnishing a bond of $1,000 on account of his youth. John Matthews escaped from jail after his conviction with his nephew Wiley Matthews, but was captured and returned to jail. John Matthews made the following confession on March 17, 1888. To the Honorable Circuit Court of Christian County, I want to make a statement of my case. I will tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I'll tell you what I had done and what I saw done. I was in the house. I did not go in the house to do anything, and I did not think of any such thing when I went in. I went in to try and stop the shooting. I hollered out, "Stop that shooting, in the name of God, what do you mean?" Some men threw down on me with a pistol. I said, "Don't shoot me, I'm trying to stop this." I saw he was going to shoot, and I turned my head to keep him from shooting me in the face. He shot me across the back of the head and knocked me down. I got up, he threw down on me again. To save myself, I struck him with my gun. I turned around and saw Will Walker shoot a man. I said, "Stop that, in the name of God, what do you mean?" I then ran out the gate. I was very sick. I heard someone say, "Don't shoot that woman." I turned around and saw someone shoot back in at the door. I said, "Don't let him shoot anymore." Dave Walker took hold of him and said, "That'll do." He came out of the gate holding Will up. I said, "What's the matter?" Will said, "I'm shot, but while they were getting me, I got 3 of them." I got on my mare and went down the road and came to some men, heard Charlie Graves say, "If all the slickers were served that way, I could rest easy." Wiley Matthews told me on Sunday after the killing that he shot one of the men to save me. Charlie Simmons got his blood from the wound on my head. He had nothing to shoot with. Dave Walker wanted me to take Bill away that night after the shooting. I told him I had done nothing to run away for, and I was going home. Bull Creek Dave Walker made a statement of the killing as follows. When the shooting began, I was about 150 yards from the Eden's house. When the men started toward the house, I was in the rear of the company riding John Matthews' horse. Joe Inman or someone told me to stop the boys or they would get into trouble. I called out to the men ahead, "Hold up," but they did not stop, and I galloped after them to prevent trouble. Immediately after this, the firing began at the house, and I shouted, "Stop that shooting! What does that shooting mean?" I galloped toward the house to stop the shooting. When I got near the yard gate, the men came out of the house, and I heard that my boy was shot. I did not go into the house, but would have done so if the firing had not stopped. I did not see Charles Green or William Edens that night. I did not know they were killed until after leaving the house. I said nothing about going back to the house to kill the women and children, and no such thing was talked of that night. Ozark, Missouri, May 10th, 1889. The carpenters this morning gave their scaffold its finishing touches, and everything was ready by 8 o'clock. Very few persons were admitted, but everything could be heard from the outside through the open windows. The scene was very affecting. John Matthews made a long prayer which could be distinctly heard in the street fronting the jail. The prisoners ate their supper with as much relish as usual and appeared very quiet, except Matthews, who is taking his fate very hard. He passed a restless night, praying at short intervals, asking the Lord to give him the strength to go through the ordeal, and claiming he was a martyr. His sleep was restless, waking up at short intervals, and he could be heard moaning. One of the guards informed this correspondent that Matthews did not sleep over 2 hours during the night. The two Walkers retired about 9 o'clock, But soon after, the guards coming into the corridor called to them to their cell and talked with them until about 11, at which time they went to sleep and did not wake until after 4 o'clock. They stated that they rested well. The prisoners were up at an early hour this morning and ate their breakfast at the usual hour. The jail was full of guards armed with Winchesters, shotguns, and revolvers, and were in the charge of Captain G.W. Taylor, who was the foreman of the grand jury which indicted the Bald Knobbers and is known here as the Special Bald Knob Grand Jury. Your correspondent noticed the Honorable J.J. Brazil, member of the legislature, who is at home on a furlough among the guards. Quite a number of people from the country came in, but the number of strangers was not very large, as few people were permitted to witness the execution. Matthew's wife and mother came in last evening, and it was learned this morning that several other of his relatives were here. Divine services were opened in the jail at 7:30 o'clock, conducted by the Reverend Thomas Hanks, D.E. Greystone, and T.B. Horn, assisted by a few Christian ladies. The service was continued up to the hour of execution. John Matthews took part in the exercises and delivered an earnest prayer in loud voice. William Walker also led in prayer once, but persons on the outside could hear very little that was said by him. An opening was cut this morning through the brick wall leading directly into the place of execution. A beautiful oak sapling covered with beautiful green leaves stood near this opening under which the prisoners were to pass. A visit to the gallows this morning revealed it to be a structure of fair strength, although it looked weak. A stairway led up to the scaffold, and a trap door was placed in the center. Above it was the crossbeam, to which were suspended 3 ropes with nooses ready. The height of the trap door above the ground was nearly 10 feet. At 8:53 o'clock, the sheriff entered the jail and read the death warrant to the doomed Bald Knobbers, after which Thomas Delaney, one of their attorneys, was admitted to have an interview and bid them farewell. John Matthews came to the window and had a conversation with this correspondent. He said, "I have to die, but thank God I can say I am innocent and have told the truth all along about this matter. I have told the truth and have nothing to regret. I went out through the hole, not because I was guilty, but to escape a shameful death. But it was the will of God that I should die, and I ought to be proud of it. I was a soldier in the Federal Army, and am proud of my record. I am willing for the people who have known me all my life to say what kind of man I have been." At 9:10 o'clock, the prisoners commenced dressing themselves for the scaffold and finished their toilet at 9:20. They were dressed with white shirts, linen collars, black cravats, low slippers and black coat, vest, and pants, an imitation of broadcloth. The jury and reporters were admitted to the inside at 9:20 o'clock. Just before leaving his cell, John Matthews proclaimed his innocence in a loud voice. The sheriff helped Matthews up the steps. Young Walker followed with a firm step, his father following close behind, as firm as ever. At the trap, a short prayer was delivered, after which all joined in singing. T.B. Horn rendered a selection from the Book of Job. Reverend Thomas Hanks delivered a beautiful prayer. The noose was adjusted at 9:40. John Matthews said he had nothing to add, and he was there, but took no part in the crime. Matthews called on all who were willing to help his little ones to hold up their hands. Nearly everyone in his sight held up their hands. The black caps were adjusted at 9:51. At 9:53, the drop fell. John Matthews fell praying. The stretch of the rope let all fall to the ground. The rope broke, and William Walker fell loose and lay there struggling and groaning. He talked for 3 minutes when he was taken up by the sheriff and deputies on the scaffold. Dave Walker was drawn up and died in about 15 minutes. Matthews lived about 13 minutes and died with his feet on the ground. The scene was horrible in the extreme. Matthews and Dave Walker were cut down at 10:10. The trap was again adjusted, and William Walker lifted helpless and groaning and gurgling and almost insensible, and the rope again adjusted and the trap again sprung. This time, the descent came to a sudden stop with his feet full 30 inches from the ground, and he died without a struggle. In about 14 minutes, when he was cut down, the bodies were laid on a white sheet spread on the ground and covered with another. Probably 1,000 people from the country came into town during the forenoon. No doubt more would have come had it not been known that the execution would be private. The sheriff and his deputies had no previous experience in conducting executions and thought they had made sufficiently perfect arrangements to prevent any blunder. They were mistaken, however. The ropes were adjusted badly, and the result was simply frightful. The scene at the execution was horrible in the extreme and does not need to be enlarged upon to make the readers sick at heart. The people have been very quiet all day. They discuss the revolting scene at the scaffold and are somewhat bitter in their denunciation of the bungling work. Most of the people in this county think the hanging was a very unjust punishment, but recognize the fact that it was the duty of every good citizen to submit to the enforcement of the law. That was Bald Knobber 2, The Botched Execution of Chief Bull Creek Dave. For headline clippings, illustrations, and source information, please visit www.truecrimehistorian.com. While you're there, you can also buy one of my books or A Scoundrel Tea, or you can follow the links to my social media pages where you can shoot me some virtual love at iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Any gesture from you, whether it's social media love or the purchase of a book or scoundrel tea, will allow me to continue digging into the historical archives and present you with interesting tales of madness, murder, and mayhem for free. And I also welcome suggestions to dig up source documents on some of your favorite crimes. Now for the announcement. While the details are yet to be worked out, I am pleased to tell you that I've signed on to be a participant and a presenter at the inaugural CrimeCon to be held June 9th to 11th in Indianapolis, Indiana. This convention will bring together thousands of true crime fans with their favorite true crime producers, like yours truly. The full slate is yet to be announced, but I wanted to get it out there so you can get the early bird pricing. Visit www.crimecon.com for details. And don't forget, if you're looking to make the perfect hire, visit ziprecruiter.com/first and place an ad for free. Music by Dave Sands. This is true crime historian Richard O. Jones signing off for now.